Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Bite-Sized Blessings. Thank you so much for all the ratings and reviews for my birthday week. I got quite a few more reviews, and I'm so grateful to those of you who chose to do so. If you're a new listener, please consider going to the platform of your choice and giving me a rating, maybe writing a little review. I'd so appreciate it. I also got two more Patreon supporters this week, Beth Gutelius and Steve Sink. Both are dear friends, and I know that both of them have my back in so many different ways. For those of you who'd like to support me, there will be a link under the episode's show notes. For $3, $5, or $10 a month, you get some assorted goodies every month, but you'll know that you're helping me put really beautiful content out into the world. Now, my guest, Ethan Hope. He is the owner of Hope Therapeutics here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Ethan is a third-generation healthcare provider. His grandmother is a nurse, and his father was a family doctor, but also served as a Navy doctor for a MASH unit in the jungles of Vietnam. Ethan has a fascinating story, and by now, I think you'll notice there is no bite-sized option for this week's episode, because I truly think that the entire episode is absolutely necessary. You have to listen to the whole thing. It's filled with so many inexplicable experiences that I kind of want you all to get the full dose of bite-sized blessings this week. Ethan speaks a little bit about his background at the beginning, but then he goes into more detail about just how magical his life has been. So now, episode 110 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
And I've had experiences in Peru in which someone was singing, and I saw these, like I was in a different world with these different, it's very hard to put into words, but like it's a completely different landscape, you know. And I had a sense that it was an Oyarao landscape, and after the ceremony I asked the teacher, were you opening up the world of Oyarao? And he said yes. You know, I think I'm like every other person, which is like an amalgam of their past, all the various parts that make us up.
So your vocation, you're a physical therapist now.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always that way. You've had this journey to get to where you are at this moment in time.
Yeah.
And what did that look like?
When I was young, when I was 8, my brother was diagnosed with a pretty rare cancer and was sick for 3 years and passed when he was 14 and I was 11. So that event obviously really shapes who I am as a person, as well as how I operate as a healer. And you know, I had a pretty traumatic and difficult childhood, and so I've done a lot of work on myself, and I think was able to transmute some of that into who I am today.
I just think your journey is so interesting. And, you know, I think you went to school for physical therapy, is my understanding.
Yeah.
And then you stepped away from that for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you returned.
Right.
So how did that happen?
Okay. So, I graduated from physical therapy school in 1998. And at that time, my intention was to open up my own practice. And when I started working, I worked at a community hospital on the southwest side of Chicago, and it was a good place to start my career because we had lots of time with patients, and it wasn't So the demands for productivity and all that weren't the reality that most PTs deal with today. And so after working for a couple of years, I have a bachelor's. I started taking some master's level courses, which I didn't need to do. I just did. And I quickly realized that I didn't really need more academic knowledge, that this is really a hands-on profession. And so I sought out various fellowships and decided to do an orthopedic manual therapy fellowship at Kaiser Northern California, which is the oldest fellowship for PTs in the country. From there, went to Boston to work at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and worked as a clinical specialist there. Really, they brought me in to teach these techniques and approach to the other therapists. And then I became sort of disenfranchised with PT for a number of reasons. One, like, the cost of living in Boston is really high. And at the time, most healthcare providers get paid less if they work at a Harvard hospital. It's sort of like, oh, you should be so lucky to work here, and kind of thing. And also, I started to get kind of bored with PT. And so I ended up, through creative networking, connecting with a partner at Deloitte & Touche. And I subsequently, like a year later after I met with her, was offered a job in a niche healthcare regulatory and compliance practice. And so then in 2018, I went to Peru for 2 months and I did initiation with the Shipibo lineage. And after that, slowly started to incorporate some of what I learned in that initiation in my clinical practice. And that's really what changed a lot of things for me and my relationship with PT. So the thing that I like the most about what I do is actually the relationship with patients. I mean, and of course, helping them. But I also think that there's the relationship between a patient and a healer or healthcare provider is really a sacred thing. And I think that in our current medical system, that has really been lost. And that, and I think at the sort of bedrock of this relationship is trust. You earn someone's trust in a number of different ways, right? And I think the first part of it is actually genuinely like listening to people and hearing them, honoring who they are as a person, regardless of what their background is. And I think that that's been lost in the sort of modern healthcare system. And so when I started to shift how I viewed what I was doing and sort of changed my approach, I found that I was much happier and really get more satisfaction out of my work.
I'm so curious, when you went down to Peru, were you planning on being initiated or was it?
Yeah, no, it was, I knew, yeah.
Okay.
For sure. Now, I wasn't sure I would. I was hoping I'd be able to complete it because it's not the easiest thing to do, but I did.
Yeah, I was going to ask because, I've read Molly Domasome's book of Water and the Spirit, and he talks about doing initiation at age 18 or 19, and everyone else who's being initiated is 11, 12. But because he got taken away by Jesuits when he was young, he never went through that rite of passage. Mm-hmm. And it's very different when you're almost 20 going through that versus when you're a lot younger.
Yeah.
And he very plainly says not everybody makes it.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody makes it. There's no guarantee.
For sure.
That you're going to make it. Yeah. So I think, you know, that's a really courageous and brave decision.
Thank you.
A really amazing decision, because I don't think I would have thought of that as a possibility, you know? So how did that come to you, that was a possibility in your life?
I had a friend that had done this initiation and had told me about it. And then I went down to Peru for like a 10-day retreat. And that was the first time that I ever sat in a Shipibo ceremony. And it was life-changing. So I've been working with ayahuasca for like 9.5 years. And for the first 4 or 5 years, I sat in mestizo ceremonies. So the songs are in Spanish. There's similarities as well as differences. And the only way I can describe it is, and this is for me, because there's lots of people that resonate with mestizo tradition. But for me, mestizo ceremonies were like 3D and the Shipibos were like 5D. And, you know, one of the things about, so the Shipibos believe that their language was taught to them by the plants. And so the experience of their songs in their native language much more powerful for me. And so then when I was down there for the 10 day, or someone else was talking to me about this initiation, and I was like, I think I need to do that. And then I was like, I need to do that. And I decided that, so I was at that time 44, and I thought about, well, I want to do this. The first time I did ayahuasca was right around my 40th birthday. So I really liked the idea of doing it around my 45th birthday. And so we got back into town and I looked at the website, and there was actually a retreat, an initiation that spanned my birthday. And there was one spot left. And so I filled out the application and actually called my wife from Iquitos, Peru, and was like, hey, I think I need to do this initiation. And she was like, do it. And so I came back, and I don't remember how many months it was between them, but I came back, and then I met with my employer, and they had known that I was going down to do this ayahuasca retreat. And then I said, you know, I need to be gone for like 2 months. I understand if you need to hire someone else. And they were really gracious, and they said, I will hold your position. And so then I went and did it.
Wow. That's amazing. There was only one spot left.
Yeah.
It bridged your birthday.
Yeah.
And your employer says, go for it.
I know, right?
All of those are miracles.
Totally.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's astonishing.
Yeah.
Before you went down to Peru, were you aware of the cosmology?
Oh my Shipibo. Gosh.
Yeah, Shipibo people.
No.
Okay.
I wasn't. I mean, a little bit from talking to my friend, but certainly not to the depth that I came to understand it from being down there. And the truth is, like, I, you know, as a Westerner, I'll never know what it feels like to have the same worldview that they do. You know, it's impossible. But I certainly learned a lot about their cosmology and sort of approach to illness. And I think, you know, that kind of their approach to illness has really affected how I do my work. You know, there's no separation between mind, body, and spirit. It's all the same. And so physical problems certainly can be physical, but there can be other dimensions, whether it's from, you know, someone's state of mind or their spiritual outlook and all of that.
That's beautiful. I actually do believe that.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah. Well, I'm so curious. Did you grow up in a religious household, or what did that look like for you?
So I grew up Unitarian Universalist. I'm actually a third generation Unitarian. My mother's parents became Unitarians, and my mom grew up Unitarian. So I grew up largely in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And so from like first to 10th grade, went to the Unitarian church there. And at the time, that was the fastest growing Unitarian church in the country. I wouldn't call most Unitarians religious. So both my parents, or my father was a physician, and my mom has a science background as well. And so I would say that I was brought up more in sort of a physical, materialistic worldview, rather than a spiritual, religious worldview.
Okay. You know, one of my questions was going to be, you told me this beautiful story about the mother tree in their belief system. And, you know, it's just so, it's a powerful symbol. The tree is a symbol all over the world.
Yeah.
For so many different cultures, so many different religions. Mm-hmm. The tree is like at the root of everything.
Yeah.
And the story you told me was just lovely. And was it ever a challenge to kind of learn about the cosmology with your science background?
Yeah.
You know, of how you grew up?
Yes.
Was it difficult to marry those two?
Yes. You know, I'm somebody who has to like experience. So I would describe myself as a mystic, in the sense that like I need to have a certain experience in order to believe something, as opposed to being told to believe something and just believe it. And so, yeah, certainly when I was down there, you know, it took me a little while to sort of wrap my head around some of these concepts. However, and the experiences that I had defied sort of logic and science and these kinds of things. And so through that, I came to believe that there's definitely something to what they're talking about. So would you like me to talk about the tree?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So, and let me first just say that, you know, just like lots of other indigenous groups, there's different sort of lineages within these groups. And so this Shipibo lineage that I work with, at the kind of center of the lineage is this tree you mentioned. And the tree is called the Noya Rao tree. And that roughly translates as flying tree. She's believed to be the tree of life, the tree of light, as well as a direct connection to the divine or God, whatever language one wants to use. And so, and for the longest time, it was believed to be a fable. There were no Noya Rao trees. Part of the fable is there were all these trees, and then they left. And then my teacher, which we refer to as Maestro, there was a Noya Rao pipe that was passed down. And that's sort of how they would connect with the spirit of this tree. He then had a dream of where there was a tree, and it was there. And currently there are I want to say like three or four that are known to exist in Peru. It's also believed that it's an enlightened tree. Some people believe this has not happened yet, but some people believe that other trees could actually sort of become Noirao trees. Now that I haven't seen that happen. And so the tree is a bioluminescent tree. When the leaves fall to the ground, they glow in the dark. And, you know, this is a really good example of sort of an experience I witnessed more than once that defies logic and science. Specifically, this happened a couple times. You go to the tree, obviously you have to go at night, which is a bit of an ordeal because there's lots of poisonous snakes. And so, you know, we got to the tree and there was a group of us and there were definitely glowing leaves. And then after a period of time, enough time, by the way, for our eyes to have adjusted to the darkness, because we had turned off our flashlights, we started to sing the songs that we sing, which are referred to as Icaros. And the jungle floor just like lit up. And I was like, wow, there's something happening. Within the South American shamanic tradition, there is this practice referred to as a dieta, which translates as diet, which is, can be confusing because there is a food diet associated with the plant diet. But really what a plant diet or plant dieta is a spiritual contract, so to speak, with a plant or a tree in which you ingest a decoction of, in the case of Noirao, generally it's like they take some of the roots or some bark from the roots and they soak that in water. And then you fast and then you consume that extract, which is, in the case of Noirao, is a non-psychoactive thing. And the Noirao diet was the first diet that I ever did. So what the way it works is you have to be fasting in order to take the extract. I did a week fast, no food, and took the Noirao in every day for that. And part of what you're doing, you know, you're spending a lot of time in isolation and you're doing ceremony 3 nights a week. And really what you're trying to do is sort of connect to what they would refer to as the spirit of this tree. Initially, I was like, I didn't feel any, what am I supposed to feel, right? And then, you know, I had some really powerful experiences in ceremony. And I'd done, you know, I've been at this point, been working with ayahuasca for like 5 years. And had a fair amount of experience. And the things that happened during this Noirao diet were profound and very different from previous experiences with ayahuasca. So the cosmology of this lineage is that it's believed that Noirao has planets, worlds, and, well, let me backtrack. So in the mestizo tradition, they generally will diet on lots of different plants. In my lineage, we diet on a small number of plants in general. And so in all but one of those plants is believed to exist in the world of Noirao. And so everybody starts with a Noirao diet. It's sort of the foundational diet in this lineage. And then we were given a choice for the second half to do a different diet. And so I chose as my second diet a plant called Marusa. And Marusa, and in her name in Shipibo is Incan Kenna. And she's a very sensitive plant, believed to be very sensitive. And when you're doing a diet with her, you become exquisitely sensitive. She's believed to be the hospital of the jungle. And the other reason I chose to work with her is because she teaches energy healing. And so I, at the time, because I'm a manual therapist and I do a lot of hands-on stuff, I thought that would make a lot of sense. You know, so I came back from that, the initiation, and it took me a little bit of time to start incorporating these songs into my practice. And I think, so I think it's worth talking a little bit about sort of this, the songs and what the idea is. And so within this lineage, these songs are, one who's singing the song is actually like singing to this person's ailment or pain or whatever it is that they have going on. And they don't, these songs, and I believe that the Shipibos would agree with me that they don't, I mean, it's not just for ceremony. They can be sung outside of ceremony, like within the context of what I'm doing. It does not require people to be ingesting ayahuasca in order to experience the benefits from these songs. And so, you know, I would ask folks that might seem to be open to it. And I would say, you know, I sing these indigenous healing songs and I'd be happy to sing to you while I'm doing this hands-on work on you. And so I started doing that kind of every so often. And then I had such a positive response that I just kind of kept doing that. And I don't sing to every single person I work with. It's very much an offering. And if people resonate, then great. And if not, that's fine too. And I incorporate these songs in with my hands-on treatments that I would be doing anyway. And the response has been, you know, really positive and also really interesting to hear what people say after the experience. So
I know I've had one of those experiences.
And so, you know, I've sung to people of all different ages and backgrounds, and I hear really interesting things. So like probably one of my favorite stories is this person was just kind of a conventional person, not a medicine person or anything. And I was seeing her for her knee and I made this offering and she said yes. So I sang to her and I was working on her knee, kind of combining some physical techniques as well as energy work, which is typically what I do. And I asked her after, well, how was that for you? And she said to me, you know, I just had this feeling inside of my knee that it was going to get better. And I was like, that's perfect. Exactly. So I should say, you know, when I'm doing this, you know, I'm in calling on the spirit of this plant or the tree. Whether or not that is real to me is secondary. You know, I think one in our culture, like as adults, how often do we have somebody sing a song just for us, you know? And so I think that can be just deeply healing in and of itself. But I've had people tell me that they, you know, we're floating above the table. I've had grown men start crying on the table. I've had people tell me about, you know, that it engendered memories, some of which were difficult memories, but it was still really healing for them. Yeah, I mean, I think kind of going back to your question about sort of having this Unitarian framework and kind of going into all this, you know, I'm not someone who's going to believe in magic because someone tells me to believe in magic, but I do believe what people tell me and the experiences that they have. And so, you know, I just kind of kept doing it, and it's become a fairly big part of my practice.
I had one of those experiences that was astonishing, and I've been talking about it ever since I saw you. And I've been telling everybody since I saw you. It was so surprising to me because I was just lying on the table and you were singing. And all of a sudden in my mind's eye, I saw this little, I couldn't define what it was, but it looked like a reptile. And it kind of stuck its head in and moved around a little bit and was like looking and observing. It was checking things out. And I thought, what was that? And, you know, I'm supposed to be enjoying and healing the song, but I'm like, I want to categorize right. What that, and I could not figure it out. So then you finish and I get up and you said, did anything happen? And I said, well, just randomly, like, I don't know what it was. It wasn't a snake. It wasn't a monitor lizard and it wasn't a Komodo dragon, but something came in and was checking out what was going on. And you said, was it a dragon? And I said, yes, that's what it was. I couldn't categorize it because when did we see dragons in our life? I just knew that it was a reptile and it was curious. Mm-hmm. It was not malicious. It was kind of just checking things out, wanted to know what was happening. And you said, oh, well, one of the songs I sing is about a dragon. I think that's what you said, right?
Yeah.
And so that kind of blew me away.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even though you said dragons are mythical creatures, in my mind, I think, how is that even possible? Because it showed up.
Yeah.
So in that respect, it's not a mythology.
Right.
It's actually real. Maybe it only exists in the spiritual realm or in this higher realm.
Yeah.
You know, this energy of dragon or this persona of dragon or whatever that creature looks like, but it came and checked things out.
Yeah.
But I also said, you also said that you have dragon inside of you, I think is what you said.
Well, I was told by one of my teachers that, so going back to Marusa, the plant that I mentioned was my second diet, that there's a dragon associated with Marusa. And one of my teachers said that dragon is in me. And so he actually, this guy actually wrote for me the song that I sang to you, which is calling on that spirit of Marusa and this dragon for healing purposes.
That's astonishing because I have to tell you, it was the nicest dragon. Yeah. So sweet.
Yeah.
Sweetest dragon ever.
Yeah.
If I was, you know, we've all watched Game of Thrones. It was not that kind of dragon.
Right.
It was like a really sweet dragon. So
yeah. Do you remember what color it was?
He was green. He was like a darkish green, darkish brown green.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say he was bemused, but he definitely was very curious. I don't know if he was trying to see if you're doing things correctly, but he kind of was checking the whole thing out. It almost felt like an initial visit. You know how you go see your doctor for the first time? You have the initial visit to kind of get the lay of the land of the patient. That's kind of what it felt like, an initial visit.
So did it have a masculine energy? Is that why you're calling it a he?
Oh my God, I'm gender biased with dragons.
Yeah.
You know, that's horrible. I can't believe that. Let's see. You know, I did get a male presence.
It may be. You know, I don't know.
I don't have never met a female dragon, but it was, I was so perplexed by what it was that I don't know why I just automatically went, he, that's kind of telling, isn't it? But whatever it is, I want to meet the dragon again.
Right.
I do. I want to have a conversation and approach it with respect. So, But that it was kind of thrilling, to be honest. I was so excited after you told me that, and I loved you, and I've just been thinking about it ever since. It's so beautiful. So does every plant have an animal associated with it?
Not necessarily. No, not that I know of. So, but like in the case of Noia Rao, there are the way that I understand it is that there are certain animals that exist in the world of Noia Rao. For example, there's a white tiger that's associated with Noia Rao, but I don't know about, the dragon thing came up after I did my initiation and was doing some remote work with a teacher. So I don't know.
Okay. And you talk about the world of Noia Rao, and I think earlier you used the word planet, or there are planets associated. Now, are you saying in another galaxy, or are you saying in another dimension, or in the imaginal world, or all of it?
I don't really know. The Shipibos talk about worlds or planets in relation to these plants. So I'll tell you, in the song, some of the songs, they actually are said to be opening up the world, say, of Noia Rao. And I've had experiences in Peru in which someone was singing, and I saw these, I was in a different world with these different, it's very hard to put into words, but it's a completely different landscape, and I had a sense that it was a Noia Rao landscape. And after the ceremony, I asked the teacher, were you opening up the world of Noia Rao? And he said, yes. Again, the skeptic in me could be like, well, you were under the influence of ayahuasca. And yet I've been under the influence of ayahuasca many other times and never had such an experience. And then, the same teacher had also was singing to me and was calling on Marusa, and I saw all these kind of beings. So in the ayahuasca world, both indigenous and mestizo traditions, they refer to these beings as doctorcitas, which is like little doctors in Spanish. And they can show up in all different ways. And lots of people will describe having these experiences of these beings or creatures coming and doing work on them. And I've had that experience numerous times with Marusa, and even one time these beings literally said to me, don't even try to understand what we're doing, because you won't. It almost felt like they were doing sort of a brain surgery on me. And I know it does sound sort of out there, from our sort of Western scientific perspective. And I think, whether or not it's real might be irrelevant. It's really the meaning making and the experience that we have around it, right? And what, how we feel afterwards. So I don't know, it's frankly, it's a mystery to me, but I've had these experiences that sort of defy logic, science, and nothing against logic and science. I think they're really valuable, but we can't explain everything. We don't know how the brain really works.
I think what I'm hearing you say about Noia Rao is it almost seems like Noia Rao came from another reality, and a few of them decided to stay here to help maybe humans understand that there is more to this whole thing than we, they're almost like emissaries, hoping that we get a clue.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because there's, so this isn't about Noé Arao per se, but it's related. There's a very well-known ethnobotanist, I believe it was Dennis McKenna who said this, who's Terence McKenna's brother, that he postulates that, so, you know, ayahuasca has been in the jungle, again, it's unclear for how many hundreds or thousands of years it's been used, because, you know, one of the things about the jungle is everything gets destroyed. You know, it's like, it's just, you know, it's so humid and like, everything just rots, you know? So, and the Shipibo language also, it was not a written language. So they can write it down phonetically, but it wasn't written. So anyway, how long it's been used up for debate. So McKenna postulates that the reason why, so ayahuasca has left in a very like pretty short period of time, right? Has left the jungle. It's like all over the world now. And so his theory is that the reason that's happening is because the plant kingdom is in peril. And so it's a way to sort of wake people up, you know, at least certain people, and maybe a way for the plants to somehow communicate with us to stop destroying all of them. So, yeah. So, I don't know whether, you know, there's actually, in this universe, a planet of Noé Arao, I have no idea. Or if it's a parallel reality, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It's fun imagining, though.
It is. Yeah, and I think I may have told you this, I did have the experience of, in a ceremony in which the maestro was singing to me, where we flew to a planet covered in Noé Arao. But again, that's a vision, so whether that's a figment of my imagination, perhaps. I don't really know. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. It's almost, you know, I think of the movie Avatar.
Yeah, 100%.
It's totally...
It's very Avatar-like. Yes, I love that movie. Yeah.
To God, it's been, I feel like it's been a miracle a minute with you. Every minute there's like a new miracle. But I think it's important to share these stories because, you know, obviously all these movies are coming out. Michael Pollan, right? Yeah. All about MDMA and psilocybin, about all of these plant medicines. Some are not necessarily plant medicines, but right. New ways of healing, of dealing with PTSD, of moving beyond the self and losing, like having your ego dissolve. Mm-hmm. Ayahuasca is in that category. And I think that you've absolutely told a lot of stories that are miraculous and really interesting. And who's to say, as you said, what's real and what's not?
Yeah.
You know, these are your experiences.
Yeah.
But I think it's helpful for other people to hear these stories and understand that these things are possible for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and I do actually really resonate with your statement that it's the plant world, you know, ayahuasca is the emissary from the jungle saying, please help us stop destroying us.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you just made me think of something, you know, so historically, and so part of the reason why mestizo shamanism emerged was because the indigenous groups wouldn't teach their traditions to someone outside of their lineage or, you know, tribe, so to speak. So as I understand it, my teacher, Enrique, basically was told by Noé Arao, and he would say God. And interestingly enough, he would identify as a Christian.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, but he says that he was told by God and Noé Arao that he needed to teach Westerners because we're so sick. And, you know, obviously we were uniquely good at destroying ecosystems. And it's not obviously just our our country, but we are really good at it. And well, you know, I think this sort of Judeo-Christian view of dominating nature is woven through the fabric of our culture. And I think it's problematic in a lot of ways.
That's putting it mildly.
What's that? Yeah.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I already think the story of the trees all luminescing at the same time while you're singing to them is pretty...
Well, there's only one, I want to be clear, there's only one tree.
Yeah, one tree, yes.
And the weird thing is that, like, they don't glow, they're not glowing when they're on the tree. They glow when they come down, like when they're on the ground. And you can even take, you can take a leaf and bring it back into your little hut that you're staying in, and it'll still glow for like a day or two.
That's amazing. Are they, they've fallen, I assume, because they've died, right?
Yeah, just like any other.
What I find amazing about that is it's only in death that they luminesce.
Right.
So what a beautiful analogy for us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
When our souls leave the body.
Yeah.
Maybe that's, there's a story in there for us.
Yeah, I think that's astute observation. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so, you know, I'm going to share something that happened the first time that I did ayahuasca. And this is just like a snippet of what happened. But, you know, I also want to say, and this is really important, that these medicines, plant medicines, synthetic medicine, whatever, in the realm of psychedelics, it's really important for me to say that, one, they are not for everybody. I view them as a catalyst. They are not a cure-all. And I think, you know, yeah, there's a lot of research coming out, and there's been a lot of research that absolutely, like, for the right person at the right time in the right conditions, miraculous. And you still have to do your work day to day. And I think, you know, and it's really, I think it's really important to talk about, you know, this idea of integration, and it sort of gets lip service. So you can have these really profound, powerful experiences, and you have to integrate those things into your life. And it's my opinion that the magical combination for most people is, you know, working with these medicines and working with somebody to help integrate the teachings that they may have learned during the event, whether that's a therapist or a coach or somebody who's skilled at helping with integration. But it's really important, because I think, you know, there's a lot of overselling of these things, you know, like, yes, they're really powerful, but it's not like all your problems are going to be solved. Some of them may. So my first ayahuasca ceremony, which was, by the way, terrifying, and ayahuasca can be very harrowing, to put it lightly. But I had this experience, and I need to just set it up. So my father had Parkinson's, and he passed away a few weeks before our wedding. And then, you know, my life was very busy at the time. And he and I had a complicated relationship. And so in this vision, I could see him like crystal clear. Actually, he was in a Veterans Administration nursing home. And actually, when he was on hospice, and when he passed, I wasn't there. He had gone on hospice, and the doctors had said, like, I had something I had to do. I had to go for like a day. And the doctors had said that he would still be there when I got back. And that was not the case. He passed when I was away. Part of me wonders if maybe he did that because he didn't want me to be there. Who knows? But either way, you know, I wasn't there when he passed. My wife was there, and my aunt, my brother's sister. And so then, you know, fast forward, I don't know, a couple of years later, when I go to do my first retreat. And so in this vision, I saw him crystal clear. Like, I could see the room he was in, everything, down to the minute detail. And in this vision, my father proceeded to explain a lot of things to me. I mean, so my dad was a doctor in Vietnam, and so he had untreated PTSD and some other issues. And so we had a challenging relationship. And luckily, you know, before he passed, we were able to, you know, make some peace, and we're in a much better place. But nonetheless, I don't think I'd fully grieved his loss and all that was around that. And so in this vision, you know, my father proceeded to just like explain everything to me. And in like a snap of a finger, I forgave him. And, you know, that was deeply healing, because I was obviously able to really to grieve his loss, but also just to like recontextualize all these memories that I had and the meaning making I had around it. And, you know, so just going back to what you said about, you know, all this stuff that's coming out, the science shows is that we have this region. It's not really like a structure, but there's this regions of the brain that's referred to as the default mode network. The default mode network, you know, as I understand it, is sort of when we're thinking about ourselves, our past, our future, perhaps that's where our parts of our ego reside, our sense of self, right? And so when they administer DMT, LSD, psilocybin, the sort of classical psychedelics, you know, brain imaging shows that the default mode network really calms down, less activity, and then there becomes connectivity between different regions of the brain. And so the way that I conceptualize this whole thing is that, you know, when that calms down, all the stories we have around events and relationships and these kinds of things gets calmed down, and then, you know, you're able to sort of see it from all these different perspectives and recontextualize it. And that's just like a snippet of that ceremony. And there are countless other examples like that for me. And so what a gift to really genuinely be able to forgive my father. And it was like, not, you know, I came to understand that it wasn't about me. He was doing the best he could do. And, you know, he had a lot of trauma and all this other sort of stuff, you know, and I've done plenty of therapy and I'm a huge advocate of therapy. I think it's fantastic. I'm married to a therapist. There's something to be said for the calming down of the ego for a period of time in this non-ordinary state of consciousness. They did a meta-analysis of all the psilocybin studies, you know, whether it's for quitting smoking, end-of-life anxiety, quitting drinking, depression, anxiety, whatever. The one thing that's associated with a positive outcome is a mystical experience. Okay, and you can define that however you want. And so I would also add to that very first ceremony, and I may have said this to you before, the first time I did ayahuasca, going in with this, you know, sort of Unitarian like scientific perspective, what I left that ceremony that retreat was with a sense like, okay, there's more going around, more happening in this physical world than we can see. And I have no idea what that is. And I didn't then, and I still don't. I mean, I think that is sort of the mystery of things, but I do have a sense. I mean, I think there's enough stories that each of us can relate to where it's like, how could that happen? You know, whether you're in a big city and you run into someone that you, you know, haven't seen for 10 years, like, what is the chance of that? Or, you know, people who, you know, that have, you know, a loved one dies and they know, you know, there's this sort of mystery to it, you know? And so I think, and going back to the research on psychedelics, so one of the characteristics of a mystical experience is ineffable. you can't, it's like, how do you describe this, you know? And so it is, it's very difficult to describe. It's just the nature of it.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. I need to thank my guest Ethan, who was so very kind to give me some time in his day so that I could bop on down to his office and interview him in person. I love stories like Ethan's because it reminds me that we have no idea what is going on in this reality, and there are things beyond our ken that should kind of all inspire us and remind us that this place is truly magical. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode: Frank Schroeder, Music L Files, Fat Sounds, Stephen O'Brien, Sasha End, and Alexander Nakarada. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to books, artists, and other items that I think will lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Ethan. Believe in the magic. Practice humility. Know that you know absolutely nothing, and I mean nothing, about what is going on here, but be enchanted by the world and all its possibilities.